Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Monday is back, and we are glad you are back as well. I'm Mark Bayshore. T-Day, Thanksgiving Day, will also be I-Day. The comet Ison will have its close encounter with the sun on Thanksgiving Day, this Thursday. The ball of space ice could fry and shatter. That could be the end of comet Ison. Or it might survive and put on quite a show. We won't know until Thursday. If that's the case, Ison would be visible with the naked eye through December. It already has wowed observers and is considered the most scrutinized comet by NASA, but the best could be yet to come. We won't really know until Thursday. And if it does survive, it'll be visible again with the naked eye through December. Its current state, we're glad you're along here on Monday. Earlier this year, Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow introduced a bill proponents say would better serve Americans with mental disorders. Her Excellence in Mental Health measure would expand access to community mental health centers, in part by making more of them eligible for payments under Medicaid. Critics of current approaches to mental health, and there are many, often say the existing system is underfunded, fragmented, and ineffective. But despite support by both her fellow Democrats and Republicans, such as co-sponsor Roy Blunt of Missouri, Senator Stabenow's Excellence in Mental Health measure remains in committee. To explain more of what the bill would do, we welcome Bob Sheehan back to Current State. Mr. Sheehan's the Executive Director of Community Mental Health Authority of Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham Counties. Bob, good to see you.
Good to see you, Mark. Thanks.
You're keeping a pretty close eye on this measure. What's at the heart of this?
We are. It's Senator Stabenow's third attempt at getting Senate Bill 264 through the Senate and the House. It would create what are called federally qualified behavioral health centers. Currently, there is no federal definition of a mental health center. It was in law in 1963 in a sort of a vague notion, but hasn't been clarified since. This law would create these federally qualified behavioral health centers and allow for added funding, federal funding, for those centers when they serve people in their community. Closing the gap that's been left over the last 10 or so years, there's been large cuts throughout
the
country. Since
the closing of many state hospitals.
State hospitals, right. And during the recession, a lot of states cut their mental health funding. And so that gap is actually growing.
And we are at the 50th anniversary of really quite a landmark piece of legislation. It's one of the, I believe it may be one of the last bills signed into law by President Kennedy.
It was the last one. He signed it on October 31st, 1963, the last bill that he signed before his death.
Yeah. And that changed the landscape.
Right. It really created the landscape of the community mental health center system started in October of 63.
And these federally qualified centers, the Ingham County Health Department right now, I know it has a federally qualified designation. Tell us a little bit more about that designation.
Sure, that would be a parallel. So Ingham County Health Department and nonprofits across Michigan run what are called federally qualified health centers for primary care, physical health care. This would create a parallel set of mental health centers that would be federally qualified behavioral health care centers. Behavioral health care is the term we use for mental health care. So it'd be a parallel across the state.
And there is some bipartisan support for this. Debbie got Republican Roy Blunt to be the co-sponsor. Marco Rubio of Florida is on board. What do you make of this bipartisan support?
Well, it's rather unique, and we like to see it. I think it's coming from two sources. I think some of the co-sponsors believe that this kind of treatment is needed, this kind of access. And some of the co-sponsors are signing on out of reaction to some of the gun violence. I hate to say that, but I know that that's where some of the motivation comes from.
And in community mental health is would be a federally qualified mental health center?
We would have to apply for this
for that designation.
We would,
okay.
Yep.
And there are similar measures here. We've been talking about Debbie Stabenow's bill, Senate Bill 264, but a similar measure exists in the House as well.
Right, 1263 in the House, exactly.
Okay. And Senator, I understand Senator Stabenow visited your facility in March to campaign for the measure. Is it fair to say this measure is stalled
I think,
or not?
That's a good point. Often in the Senate and the House, too, they try to build up a large list of co-sponsors, and that's what Debbie's trying to do at this point. The last two times they put it through, it was a very thin co-sponsorship list. Now it's growing like we haven't seen before. So she wants to get virtually a done deal, and I think it makes a lot of sense before it goes to the Senate floor.
Does the anniversary of Sandy Hook tragedy play into this?
It does, sadly so. So as I tell friends, we'll take anything we can to expand the system. I'm just saddened sometimes that people, it's the fear of mental health conditions that sometimes drive people to support this kind of bill. Mm-hmm. And Sandy Hook, unfortunately, helps to fuel that fear.
Let's assume the best. If this passed, how would that change your operation here based in Lansing?
Great question. So we're primarily funded by Medicaid and state general fund dollars. Medicaid is a good program. It'll expand significantly here in Michigan in April. But even after that, there'll still be about 30,000 to 40,000 people in the Tri-County area with no mental health coverage, not through private insurance, not through the exchanges, not through Medicaid. So that gap can only be filled by states stepping up to the plate. Well, states like Michigan don't have a lot of cash to put forward.
And in your view, Bob, what price do we pay for that oversight?
Oh, it's a large price. In the kids' side, kids fail in school, fail in getting along with friends, fail in the juvenile justice system because of it. Adults fall out of work. They fall out of relationships. They fall out of marriages. Seniors live a life of desperation and anxiety because of it. So that's the gap we're talking about. The bill that Debbie's putting forward, though, will actually put federal money across the country into these mental health centers to let us to make sure we can serve those not on Medicaid as well, which, again, will be a large segment of our population.
Do you expect something to happen? Is there something special about the calendar year, about to come to an end here in terms of any more momentum for this legislation?
Right. Senator Stabenow's office is hoping to tag this on to other bills going through the Senate. There are a number of health care bills going through. The Affordable Care Act has unleashed an awful lot of Democrat and Republican activity related to health care, and there are a number of good bills that this could be tied on to. And so Senator Stabenow's office is working for Michigan House and Senate members to sign on board and support the bills that moves through both houses attached to another bill.
And I take it that part of the momentum here is an effort to create parity between purely physical disorders, which are, I take it, you believe are more widely acknowledged as legitimate expense, and mental disorders, and really creating greater parity.
That's right. So I'm glad you said that. The parity law was passed by Congress, and the rules went into effect this several months ago, actually. But without access, parity is sort of a moot point. You can tell people they have care that's on par with physical health care, but if you don't have access to the care, and this bill would give access to the care, it doesn't mean much. So we're impressed that Senator Stabenow knows that, and she wants to put the parity bill at its, you know, where it should be, with full access.
Tom Watkins, who is a guy you probably know as a mental health official in Wayne County, wrote in an op-ed piece late last week that it was important for Michigan House members to take more of a lead here now. With a GOP majority in the House, how likely is progress there? Is progress more likely in the Senate or in the House?
I think it's more likely in the Senate. But the House has a lot of supporters. Mike Rogers, the congressman from this area, has signed on. We're hoping that Dave Camp and Fred Upton, two Republican leaders in the House, will join Senator Stabenow and Mike Rogers in supporting the bill.
And why? Do you have any idea why they're hesitating?
There's a cost to it. These are Medicaid dollars that will actually be used to fund these centers. And so whenever you talk about federal funds, there's always discussion about whether it should be done. Both parties want to talk it through. I'm pretty sure this time Debbie has enough support in both houses and in both parties to get this through.
Are you hopeful?
I am. Okay. I am. Yeah, the bill has, I've never seen this list of supporters this long. It tends to be a handful. Now she has over 20, nearly 30 supporters in both houses, in both parties as well.
Mm-hmm. What are your most pressing challenges administering your organization right now?
Yeah, well, you know, it's sad to say this, but 50 years after President Kennedy signed the Community Mental Health Act, we still have an awful lot of stigma. We're talking about a half a century. People still view mental health conditions as something you don't talk about, you don't admit to, and you stigmatize people who have those conditions. I'm still surprised this many years later.
I know in 2013, one of the developments that you have been involved with has been a greater integration of mental health practitioners in primary care settings. That represents a change?
Yes. It's a welcome one. We have in 11 sites in the Tri-County area, we have mental health therapists and psychiatrists embedded in primary care sites. And a few months ago, the Federal Qualified Health Center, the physical health one, just opened in our buildings to serve CMH clients. So I think this Tri-County area is really ahead of the curve. Lots of folks are doing it across the state, but I'm quite proud of my physical health partners who have joined us in this.
That suggests greater parity.
It does. Yeah. It does. And greater access, so people can literally walk down the hall. If I see my physician and I express mental health needs, he or she says, come on down the hall with me. Let's go talk to a counselor. Yeah.
Are you serving a lot of veterans?
We are, more than ever, yeah. And I think there's an increased sensitivity to the mental health needs vets bring home, whether they've been in combat or not. They bring home needs that we haven't, I think, been sensitive to, and we're becoming a lot more sensitive.
Do you think that accounts for some of the, even part of the momentum behind this measure?
I do, yep. I think there's really, and I'm quite impressed, there's really a pro-veterans feeling in both houses, and I think that's fueling this as well.
Okay. Bob Sheehan is the executive director of the Community Mental Health Authority of Clinton, Eaton, and Ingham counties. We've been talking about parallel legislation in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House that would reform current approaches to mental health, primarily by creating federally qualified behavioral health centers. Bob, good to see you.
Thanks, Mark. Good seeing
luck.
You.
It's Current State on WKAR. This November, males across the nation threw out their razors and let their facial hair grow. Be free as a part of Movember, or No Shave November. Some give up shaving for a philanthropic cause, such as raising awareness for prostate cancer, while others let their whiskers grow free as a sign of solidarity. There's just under a week left till the end of the month, but some amateur beard growers might be struggling not to pick up their razors and end their itchy misery. To help No Shave participants push this through this last week, we decided to speak with some beard experts from GAFBO, the Great American Fierce Beard Organization, which is based here in Lansing. We welcome Michael Harrell. Michael, good to see you.
Thank you.
And Kevin Rathbun.
Thank you.
Is also a member of the organization. Welcome to the program. Describe your facial hair for our listeners.
Well, I've been growing my current facial hair for about 2.5 years. My beard's approximately 12 inches long and a rusty red color.
It is. I joked with Bob, our previous guest, that we had a ZZ Top segment here scheduled for the show. Kevin, what about you? You haven't been at it for quite as long.
Well, actually, I had a beard for 4 years beforehand, and actually, when I met Michael, my beard was a little bit longer than his.
Oh my gosh!
And it grew for about 2 years, and then right now I'm currently just sporting a mustache, which has been growing since February, so it's like 10 months.
The name of your organization is an attention getter, the Great American Fierce Beard Organization. You just don't encounter fierce in the name of an organization too often. How did it get started?
Well, several years back, some of our founding members were MSU students, and once a year, they would all grow beards and go out to some of the local drinking establishments and ask random people who had the fiercest beard, which was a very vague term. After a couple years of doing this, one of their members was diagnosed with cancer. So at that point, they turned the fierce beard portion into a fundraiser, and coupling that with the camaraderie and charity aspect, that is how the group was born.
And besides growing facial hair, what activities does GAFBO initiate?
We try to partner with local charities, sponsor events, participate in events. We get asked to show up for many different things, like Dickens Village, which, of course, having facial hair lends to that kind of atmosphere, Victorian Days in Grand Ledge, and Potter Park fundraising. Whatever happens, we also sponsor our own charity events once or twice a year.
Do you get into many just spontaneous discussions of what the facial hair is about and that enables you to talk about the causes?
I think that just lends it to itself. If you get a group of people around with various facial hair styles, techniques, grooming habits, you're going to start those discussions that seem maybe silly or whimsical, but then they usually progress on to more important things, community events, community involvement, things of that nature.
What's the most annoying thing about having a beard as long as yours, Michael?
You cannot eat an ice cream cone.
That is an extraordinary beard that you have there.
Thank you.
A real attention getter here. And you also participate in beard competitions. What exactly do you do at a beard competition?
At most beard competitions, there's multiple categories. So Michael, for instance, usually participates in a full beard freestyle category, and that's the one where you style your beard with, you know, rings and circles, and you basically make a style out of it. And there's full beard natural, and there's mustache categories, and there's partial beard categories, and there's groomed categories, and there's styled categories. There's usually about 10 to 12 categories, including artificial beard and even women's categories, so they participate as well. That's usually, you know, there's anywhere between, you know, 50 to 400 competitors at a beard competition.
How do women participate in this? Is there an opportunity for that?
There's generally two categories, and they do most face, most realistic fake beard, and then most whimsical. So you'll have some that hand crochet or hand knit fake beards out of yarn, any substance that looks like a real beard, and then you also have ones that just do these extremely elaborate, whimsical ones, usually with some type of theme.
How long is your beard again, Michael? Have you measured it here?
Yeah, about 12 to 14 inches, depending on if it's pulled straight or left naturally curly.
How often are you just over it?
You know, never. Days like this,
really?
Michigan winters, I'm very appreciative of my beard.
Now, beards have weaved their way in and out of fashion over the centuries. Are beards in again right now?
I would say so. You've seen a resurgence of
I see a
beard
lot of
organizations.
The shorter cropped beards.
Yep, and some of that is societal based and employment based, where some people aren't as lucky as myself, where I have a job that doesn't have any facial hair requirements, and you can just let it grow.
I think that if you pay attention to what's going on in popular culture, beards have become more acceptable again. I was growing a beard, 10 years ago, and I could honestly say I could walk into Myers, for example, and just walk through and see like one or two people with beards. And now you can walk around campus here at MSU, and it's there's more beards than I've ever seen before.
What is it about having facial hair that's so appealing for you personally?
I think it's just a freedom of choice. It's a natural state. I always called shaving ritualized face scraping. I never really enjoyed it all that much. I always kind of never liked to shave. My dad's had a beard for 40 years. My brother has a beard. My cousins have beards. My uncle. Maybe it's a family thing, but I never really wanted to get up in the morning and look in the mirror and take a piece of steel and scrape my face.
Michael, what is your daily routine for maintaining this creation here?
It's come to the point now where it does take quite a bit of maintenance.
How often do you wash it?
Every single day. Yeah. Shower, shampoo, usually some type of conditioning oil afterwards, and maybe every other day I'll blow dry it as well and straighten it out just to get all the gnarls out of it.
What about you, Kevin?
I honestly, when I had a longer beard, I spent probably 25 minutes a day minimum working on it to make sure that it was presentable, to my standards. And the mustache is much less work. It's probably a 5-minute endeavor. Mm-hmm. It's not as time consuming.
So for many people participating in Movember or No Shave November, they're heading into the final stretch. What advice do you have for them to finish it out strong?
Don't shave.
Yeah. Don't shave.
Don't give up.
Don't cave in.
Don't give up.
Just continue on. And a good point to be able to see the culmination of all this hard work on I believe it's Friday, December 6th, the MSU Beardsmen,
which is the
official student group of beard growers on campus, is holding an event at Harper's to do the charity culmination for prostate cancer research. So you'll be able to get some good tips from there, from some people that have growing. And after 4 weeks, people are probably at that awkward in-between stage where if they give it just a little more time, it'll start to look more natural and more acceptable.
After the two-week period, you kind of have an inkling of whether or not it's going to be fierce or whether it's going to be somewhat less than fierce.
Something less than fierce. Yes, the something less than fierce beard organization. What are your plans, Michael, once the month is behind us?
Oh, once this month is behind, I will continue pushing on just like I always have. My beard is here to stay for several years at
How
least.
How long can it be? Are there limits? Does it reach a point where it stops growing or it grows less fast or what?
Every person has a different, what they call terminal length, where the rate at which the hair is growing is equal to how often the hair falls out and recycles itself. So you see some people that have been growing a beard for 10 years, and it might only be this long. But then you have some people that have only been growing one for three, and they might have a 18-inch beard. I figure I get about a half inch of growth every month right now.
Do you scare little kids with that thing? I mean, it's not hard to
not
imagine,
really.
To tell you the truth.
No, every year I go to my daughter's elementary school and read a facial hair-themed book to them, and the kids love it. You know, I get all sorts of questions. How long have I been growing it? How long is it? They all want to come and touch it afterwards, so they enjoy it. They just love the whimsy of it, and I think that's part of the allure to me as well.
How many different reasons or different charities are there that are covered by GAFBO?
Oh, my goodness. We've worked with everything from the student exchange program with a city in Japan. We've worked with a bicycle restoration project that gives bicycles to underprivileged children. We've adopted a stretch of highway on 127 south of Price Road. We've been doing that for the past year where we clean up the sides of the roads.
Haven House.
Goes on and on.
Yep.
We did, what else? Trying to think. I mean, there's so many. We try to rotate because, you know, we are a local group, and everybody, obviously, has needs, and we're looking for ways to always involve ourselves. We tried to have some sort of a go-to, like we're doing our next meeting, and we're collecting for Toys for Tots, which is something we do for every single year. And there are things that are cyclical by season, and then there are things that people come and ask us to do, and you know, we generally try to accommodate as much as possible.
Michael, are you actively trying to persuade other guys not to shave at the end of November?
Oh, definitely, and not only for No Shave November, but also, being Michigan, this is a prime time for deer season, and a lot of people start growing their beards in the beginning of November just for some warmth and manliness to be out in the woods. And the people that I see at work or friends and family that I see that have started one, I'm always pressuring them to keep it going.
Is membership growing?
I would say so. We're at approximately 20 or so active members, active that we consider are coming to the majority of our events. Some days that may get up into the 30s, and some of our events are somewhat smaller. But we do hold a meeting the second Wednesday of every month, and you can just check either gafbo.com or find us on Facebook. And we change the location of our meeting every single month. We pick a local restaurant, start with the meeting at 6 o'clock for social hour from 6 to 7, and then at 7 o'clock we get into the daily business.
But skip the ice cream.
Yes, correct.
Skip the ice cream.
And this... In December 11th, our meeting is at Crunchy's in East Lansing, and we'll be collecting Toys for Tots.
GAFBO.com is the website. Michael Harrell and Kevin Rathbun from the Great American Fierce Beard Organization. Good luck. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
We'll be right back. Thanks for joining us for Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore on 90.5 WKAR. 3 months ago, Jennifer Rita was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, or MS. An artist, Jennifer decided to learn more about her disease by creating art. She started the project A Year of MS. The online journal features portraits of people with MS painted by Jennifer. Each painting is accompanied by the subject's story. By the end of the year, Jennifer hopes to have completed 365 portraits. Jennifer Rita, welcome to Current State.
Hi, thank you.
Real nice to meet you. It's such an interesting response to MS. What provoked you to start this project?
Well, MS is a lot of waiting. Waiting for your next relapse, waiting for results from different tests, and I had to keep myself busy. And the way that I express myself is through my art. It's a way of helping me heal and a way of helping keep me busy and not over-educating myself online.
And you work in watercolors or what?
There's some watercolor, some acrylic, some graphite, and some charcoal.
So we laid out the project in brief here, but give us a little bit more detail on how you line up your subjects and how you establish contact with them.
Well, I've gone through the National MS Society Michigan chapter, and they've put me up on their Facebook, and I've been talking to Marlo Donato. She's an author over in London. She's got me on her website and on her Facebook page, and we've got the blog, and so people contact me through email, and because my subjects are all over the world, we do it through pictures. They send me a bunch of pictures, and I work through those to get my portrait, and then they send me just a paragraph or so. Most of them don't want to write too much because they're not writers. So they send me a paragraph or so, and we accompany that with the portrait.
This is a chance, though, for you to bond more intimately than an awful lot of other MS patients, I think, with other people who have the disease. What's that been like?
It really is. It's very healing to hear their stories. I mean, these are some amazing people. They're one lady's run a marathon, climbed Kilimanjaro. I mean, it's just after being diagnosed with MS. Something that, you know, most of us see as this is going to stop my normal life.
How do you decide who you're going to pursue? I mean, are you getting more people responding than you have time for? I mean, how do you decide who to paint?
Well, so far I've got 79 people lined up to be subjects, so I'm still looking for almost 300 more. So if you're interested, come find me on my website.
What is that?
It is ayearofms.wordpress.com.
Okay.
But They send me their pictures and they send me their stories, and as long as it's not something that's completely negative, I'm going to use it. If it's something that's going to help me or help somebody else by hearing the story, I'm going to use it, and I'm going to do the portrait.
Which account has been most memorable for you so far?
Well, when I was first diagnosed, I was hooked up through the National MS Society with an MS peer, somebody else who had gone through MS, who was there to answer questions for you so that you could just vent to them if need be.
Of course.
And so I was able to use my MS peer who had helped me as one of my portraits. And she's the one who climbed Kilimanjaro. She races. She's a graphic
designer.
Your
MS peer climbed Mount Kilimanjaro.
Yes.
Wow. My goodness. What is the thought process like when you're hearing other people's accounts, though, other people's stories? What's going through your head?
Well, there's some stories that, you know, you just have to, you read them and then you just have to walk away from them for a couple minutes because it's like, wow, they've gone through so much more than what I've gone through, or they've gone through so much more than a normal person should have to go through.
It's a very unpredictable disorder.
It is. It's different for everybody. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why I chose to do the portraits in all the different mediums, is because each story is so different. So I wouldn't want to do them all in graphite and have them all the same, because they're not the same.
Yeah.
And each story is so different. And I'm finding through all the stories that a lot of people are diagnosed when they're having a significant life change. Like, a lot of the women were diagnosed within a year of being married. And it's because stress brings on a lot of the symptoms.
Well, it also strikes younger people in
right.
general. So.
But yeah, I mean, I'm finding through the stories that a lot of them are through major life changes that they're being diagnosed.
Mm.
So it's I think the stress
How
brings out the symptoms How that they've had for a while. But
yeah. What are the participants' reactions to seeing their portraits? What's that like?
Well, my MS peer was like, wow, it looks like me.
That's always nice
to
hear.
Well, I hope so. But they love it. I had one who called me from London crying because it was her and her daughters. And it was just, it was so beautiful to her to see it.
I can imagine. What was your understanding of MS prior to starting the project? Prior to your own diagnosis,
well,
I guess.
Honestly, the only time I'd ever heard about it was on TV shows. And most of the time it was people going into wheelchairs and, you know, not being able to walk or be a big participant in life. And so when the doctor told me that it might be MS, it kind of, I was like, oh God, I don't want to be in a wheelchair.
What's your regimen like, though, as far as dealing with the symptoms?
Well, I'm not on MS medications yet. We've got a couple other things that are going on, trying to find the right medication. And so right now,
that can take some time, I know.
It takes some time.
Several options there, and that we've made quite a bit of progress in terms of that. But at matching the medication with the patient still takes some time.
Right. There are days when I feel like $1 million. There are days when I can sleep all day. I mean, I do take a nap almost every day to conserve my energy. And it's just finding ways to conserve your energy. Because it's you don't always have it.
Right. Once you're through 365 portraits, what do you anticipate after that?
Well, we are in talks with a couple different galleries throughout the country who would like to do shows. So hopefully a year-long tour of the pictures. And then at the end of that, all the portraits will be for sale, the originals, to the people who were the subjects first, of course, and then 75% of the proceeds will go to the National MS Society Michigan chapter.
How did you first notice, when did you first realize you had a problem? I mean, how did this get started?
My husband and I were out for a walk, and I kind of blacked out, and I fell.
Mm.
And then I was having problems with my speech, and I had no strength on my right side. So we went to the doctor. We thought, well, maybe it was a stroke. And she thought, well, maybe it was a stroke. So we went in, we did MRIs and all kinds of fun tests. And then they saw the lesions on my brain and sent me to a neurologist.
And that was how long ago?
About 6 or 7 months ago.
And what was it like getting that diagnosis when they first said it's multiple sclerosis?
I remember getting in my car and telling my husband it's not. Like, it's not.
Kind of went into denial
Like, automatically went into denial. I was like, this isn't happening.
My wife was diagnosed some years ago, and the variability to this disorder is just amazing because it manifests itself in dozens, if not hundreds, of different ways. But her first experience was she got up one morning and she swore she felt like she had run a marathon the day before. Just her legs were just so weak, and that was the trigger. Can you describe for our listeners scientifically what happens in multiple sclerosis?
Well, you have a cover over your nerves. It's called myelin, and it's your immune system is eating away at that myelin.
Right.
And it causes lesions on your brain and on your spinal cord.
Right.
So depending on where the lesions occur, it affects different areas of your body.
You are currently running a Kickstarter campaign. Tell us what you hope to do with the funds.
Well, we've only got 12 hours left, so the link will be up on the 100 or a year of ms.wordpress.com. But I need it to be able to mat and frame all the pictures. I need it for supplies, so I can keep going. Paper gets expensive when you get into the artist's grade paper.
And you are basing your operation where? Are you here in the Lansing area?
I am here in Lansing. I do everything from my home studio.
Was it always your aim to be an artist? I mean, has this just come together here? You were planning on being an artist all along?
Well, I've always been an artist, but I worked in the hotel industry for about 12 years. And all through grade school and high school, I wanted to be a family law attorney.
Oh, interesting.
So a little off, but I mean, art's always been a big part of that. Uh-huh. Art was always going to be a big part of that.
Okay. Well, Jennifer, Rita, it's been a pleasure to get to know you. Jennifer is the originator of the Year of MS project. And once again, the website is
ayearofms.wordpress.org.
.com. Very good. Jennifer, Rita, continued success and best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Current state on WKAR. The Michigan State football team will be playing Ohio State this year. The Spartans are heading back to Indianapolis for the second time in 3 years to play the Buckeyes in the Big Ten championship game that's set for Saturday, December 7th. I'm already amped. MSU's tailwind seemed to accelerate on Saturday with a decisive 30-6 victory over Northwestern. The Free Press's Joe Rexroad joins us now to look back a little bit, look ahead a little bit, not just to Ohio State, but to Minnesota on the regular season finale on Saturday. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Just fine. Thank you. The Spartans' very impressive 2013 odyssey continues here. What did you take from the Northwestern game?
Yeah, I was very impressed. You know, I actually thought Northwestern had a good chance of hanging in that game on its senior day. You know, really, since losing big at Wisconsin, Northwestern has lost, you know, tons of, you know, really close games, really competitive games, and been right there against everyone. Michigan State, after a little bit of a shaky start, really controlled that game. And I just thought Connor Cook played extremely well along with Jeremy Langford. Both of those guys, probably the two biggest surprises on this team, and they're leading Michigan State to that Big Ten championship game.
It is amazing to think back on the first few games for Spartans, especially offensively, and compare the early part of the season here with what we have seen since. Really, really incredible. But let's take this in order, just like Coach D'Antonio would want us to. First, Minnesota this Saturday, senior day, with MSU certain to play in the championship game. What significance does Saturday have?
Well, certainly, you know, I asked Mark D'Antonio about this last night on teleconference, and he is, you know, he doesn't really want to talk about this because as a coach, you don't want to be public about a contingency plan for losing. But if Michigan State wins this game and loses to Ohio State, it still could get a BCS at-large bid. And if it loses this game, there's no chance of that. Michigan State will not finish in the top 14 with a loss to Ohio State. So obviously the focus is on beating Ohio State, getting to the Rose Bowl. But this game would give Michigan State 11 wins for the third time in school history, the first ever 8-0 Big Ten record, and then keep alive the possibility of a BCS at large in the case of a loss in Indianapolis.
And December 7th will be one seriously amped up day for Spartans everywhere. This offense has continued to get better all season. Yesterday, I see in the Free Press, you wrote, MSU has developed into a team that can beat teams on defense and offense. Now, the Buckeyes are really potent. Give us your thoughts here. Let's indulge in a little bit of December 7th talk. What do you make of that potential matchup?
Yeah, I think it's a great matchup, and you know, I think it's probably going to be the best conference championship game out there. And like you said, Buckeye is very potent. Braxton Miller, the quarterback, Carlos Hyde, the running back, two of the best players Michigan State will see all season, and they make everything go for them. They're, you know, just they run the option stuff, the misdirection. Braxton Miller can throw it, but he's extremely tough to tackle, to corral, as Michigan State found out last year. And Carlos Hyde is a really good running back, powerful, but he's got speed. So the defense will be tested like it has not been tested all season. But on the other hand, I don't think Ohio State's defense is great, and I don't know that it's necessarily the best Michigan State will have seen this season.
Really?
No. I mean, there's talent there, but you know, the Buckeyes have been exploring. I mean, the Buckeyes just gave up 35 at Illinois, for example, a couple weeks ago. Team Michigan State gave up 3.2. It's dangerous to get into that transitive, you know, football property, but Michigan State, I think, can score points on Ohio State and will have to score points. And I think it's going to be a really exciting, close game.
To be where we are today is exhilarating, again, compared to earlier in the season. Who gets the credit, Joe?
Well, I mean, certainly you start with Mark D'Antonio, and look, it did not look good early in the season, as you mentioned. Things looked bleak on that offense, 2 touchdowns in 2 games against inferior competition, but he stuck with it. You know, he picked Andrew Maxwell first. He switched to Connor Cook. Of course, it has turned out to be the right choice, and I think you can take a lot of credit to Dave Warner and Jim Bowman, too, co-coordinating the offense. Jim Bowman has brought some new things to the running game, and you can see that. And Dave Warner, I think, as a play caller, has been very good. Really, some very well-timed plays, some nice wrinkles last week with the little draw play misdirection that took the Wildcats off guard. So I think that, you know, the receivers coach Terry Samuel, he was getting piled on early in the year. Look at how they've developed. So at this point, I mean, there's a lot of credit to be spread around.
How hard has Dave Warner and this and the offense worked in order to get where we are here today?
Well, no question. I think the receivers, especially, you mentioned them. I mean, they were so criticized, and I think rightfully so, last year and even earlier this season, just for dropping easy passes. But they all of a sudden they're catching everything. Connor Cook, he was not able to outperform Andrew Maxwell in practice. But he worked to at least get himself even, and then you can just see he's one of those players. You get him on the field in a game with the lights on, and he just has a poise about him. So, but yeah, I think a lot of hard work certainly has gone into it, and it probably increased even after those first couple weeks when, you know, they were sort of surprised that they were struggling so much at that point.
Who do you think is in line for Big Ten Coach of the Year?
I would have to think Mark D'Antonio would be the favorite at this point. You know, Gary Anderson from Wisconsin is a really strong contender as well. And, you know, you could look at Minnesota and what they've been able to do with Jerry Kill's health problems and sort of the staff kind of stepping in for him. And that could be a possibility as well. I would think it would be one of those three. But I would think it would come down to D'Antonio and Anderson. And I just think if you're talking about an 11-1 season, with all the things that he had to do to try to fix the offense in the offseason and early this season, I think he will probably win it.
Pat Narduzzi is getting a lot of attention here, our defensive coordinator. Do you think he is being courted seriously by the NFL?
Well, I think Pat Narduzzi will be, if he goes somewhere, it will be to a college head coaching job, and there are talk out there that Connecticut is very serious about him, along with a couple of other candidates. And other jobs will certainly emerge as we get close to the end of the season. People get fired, people move around, there will be other openings. He'll have opportunities. He's not going to leave for anything, I don't think, other than a head coaching job in college that he feels he can succeed at. And, you know, he's already really priced out of the Mid-American Conference, so it'll have to be a pretty good job, but I think there's a decent chance that he will be gone this offseason.
Hmm. Well, Joe Rexroad of the Detroit Free Press, a pleasure to hook back up here, and we'll talk again.
Okay, Mark, always a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, the MSU football team has clinched a spot in the Big Ten championship game, but there's one last home game to be played Saturday, as we mentioned, against Minnesota. Much has been written about MSU's rich sports history, and the latest entry in that arena is a book called 100 Things Michigan State Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. The author is East Lansing native and MSU graduate Michael Emmerich. Current state Scott Pohl talked with Emmerich about his book at a tailgate party before the last MSU football game against Michigan.
Well, I used to work in the book publishing business for about 20 years, and one of the ideas that I came up with as an editor there was this series of 100 things blank, blank fans should know and do before they die. And we have about 20 books in the series so far on colleges. There's also some prose. And there wasn't one on Michigan State. So I thought that needed to be rectified. So I pitched the idea to the publisher, and he said, great idea, go ahead and write it. And so that's sort of the germination for the idea. I guess the one interesting note about this book is that it's the only one in the series that includes both football and basketball, which is sort of a testament to Michigan State's success in both sports. Most colleges don't really have equally successful basketball and football, and if they do, there still seems to be a strong preference for one or the other. But I would say at Michigan State, I would say both the basketball and football program are equally beloved. So that's why we did the combined. Of course, so I ended up with a book that was like 140,000 words, because there's just so much I wanted to put in, but they ended up editing it back, so now it's still more manageable, maybe 350 pages. So I tried to pick the 100 personalities, games, events, moments, traditions, game day pageantry, that sort of thing that I thought was the most essential. And so needless to say, there's quite a bit of material on the Michigan State rivalry, on the Michigan State Notre Dame rivalry. Also, things that you can do on game day, the walk, the drum line on Grand River, the band, the visiting Sparty. And then one of my favorites is maybe taking a stroll down Grand River and stopping in at Coral Gables, where 40 years ago, when the football program was sort of at its highest point, the Coral Gables was the social hotspot for MSU students and for the athletes. And the guy who owned it, which I discovered in my research, was a former football recruit, a guy recruited by Charlie Bachman in the 1930s. And so he bought the Gables back in the 60s and or 50s and 60s, and then turned it into a concert venue. And then he also, it was a spot where he would invite students who turned 21 to come there and have their first drink and then to get a free pizza. And a lot of the football players were bouncers. And anyways, it was so. If you take a trip down there, you'll definitely get a feel for Michigan State of, say, 40 or 50 years ago.
The fact that we're talking today prior to the football game with Michigan, I think, is testament to your status as a Michigan State fan, because it's my understanding, not just an MSU grad, but you now live in the Seattle area, and that you flew in for this game. So you are a true Spartan.
Yes, that is true. I live in Seattle, and I did fly in just for this game. Obviously, I have to pick and choose when I can come back, and there's no better game to come back than for this one, of course. And I kind of like to tease my Michigan friends. They're always throwing their national championships in our face. And if you actually tally up the national championships between the two programs, and you use a starting point. Now, I'm using kind of a somewhat random date, but I consider the year that we joined the Big Ten, 1950. If you look at 1950 through 2013, Michigan State has 8 national championships, 6 in football, 2 in basketball. Now, national championship, I mean, and there's some of that pregame of pageantry. years ago, the NCAA had these, what they called recognized major selectors of national championship. There were dozens of them, frankly. So if even one poll selected your school, I counted that as an F champion. So anyways, Michigan State has 8 and Michigan only has 5, which is a stat I like to throw out on the Michigan State game day.
All right, well, as a Michigan State graduate and fan myself, I'm going to use your criteria from now on when judging these things.
Yes, that's what it does.
Now, the book is called 100 Things Michigan State Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. I'm going to differentiate from other books that people might be familiar with, like 100 Places in the USA You Should Visit Before You Die. Some of these things are more historical background and fun stories rather than things to do. I want to ask you specifically about the things to do that maybe pick one that would be obscure that maybe even the biggest MSU fans haven't. I never thought of doing that. Do you have one or two of those that you might
I did spend one afternoon, and I don't know that. Yeah, I spent one afternoon wandering around looking for all of those plaques and monuments and stone markers that are tributes to Michigan State past greats. There's Ralph Young is immortalized. There are three students who died in Woodward. Three former MSU athletes, and there's just a little marker over there. I never knew anything about that before I actually started researching this book. Something else I probably didn't know, I know obviously the band plays before the game. They also play after the game. And sometimes they play with the other school. They do a drum off, which I guess probably maybe a lot of fans know that. I didn't know that. The Izzo camp out, which is obviously a sort of recent invention. You can hire Sparty to attend your wedding or your party if you're interested. I guess maybe that's about the rich stuff, I guess, in terms of what to do.
Well, so here we are enjoying one of those traditions, the Michigan State Michigan Football Saturday in East Lansing. We've got a fun book, 100 Things Michigan State Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. The author is Michael Emmerich. Thank you so much for talking with me, and good luck.
Well, thanks a lot.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we discuss how Michigan's Court of Claims is transitioning after Governor Snyder signed a bill moving it from the Ingham County Circuit Court. Also, it's time for our Great Lakes Month in Review segment. Great Lakes journalist Gary Wilson covers pet coke and Asian carp, all that and more, Tuesday here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our show's producer. Thanks as well to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.